another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my very special guest, Richard Bowker, former member of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Richard, it's good to have you on. I think you may be the very first person who has come out of the Jehovah's Witnesses to join the group, and I know that's not your primary story. We'll be talking about the charismatic movement, especially as it relates to the United Kingdom. However, the Jehovah's Witness, it's a little bit interesting to me because as I started to go through William Branham's doctrine, I started noticing key elements that actually came from the Jehovah's Witness doctrine, and I don't have it on record, so I can't say this authoritatively, but I did talk to people who knew William Branham and whose family was very close to him, and apparently there were people who were involved in his inner circle feeding him information and doctrines that made its way into the sermons, and they had come out of the Jehovah's Witnesses. So it's really interesting to me, but as I said, we'll be talking some about the charismatic groups. If you could, just start by telling everybody a little bit about yourself.
So I was born in 1946 to a rather unhappy family and dysfunctional mother. And after a brief and meaningless period in a Plymouth Brethren Sunday school, we started joining the Jehovah's Witnesses when I was about 10. And to be fair to my mother, she didn't exactly drag us in. We were as keen to join as she was. And I think partly because one thing that attracted me to the Jehovah's Witnesses, maybe not everybody, is that they tended to treat children on equal terms with adults. So they have no separate children's teaching. All the discussions that adults take part in, children also take part in on equal terms. And I found that quite intriguing. So I was, at the age of 11, reading things like The Two Babylons and the histories of mythology and all weird things like that, which I loved. Anyhow, so I continued in on that and really stopped believing it when I was about 16, 17, but stayed hanging around it because I had friends and no alternative religion till I was early 20s. And after a long while, I found my way into a form of Orthodox Christianity, which is another thing. So what I've said to you, I believe, is that the more I know about the Branham sects, the more I can see that the Jehovah's Witnesses could have been a whole lot worse than they actually were. And it gets into what the definition of the cults is. Now, let me describe them when I was there and when they got worse. Okay, when they got worse, I'll try and highlight it. So the first thing with Jehovah's Witnesses is there were just no charismatic leaders, full stop. I mean, you hardly heard of the people at the head office. They were as remote as the Pope is from the average Catholic. And in the local church, we were on first name terms with all the people who led. None of them had any great charismatic gifts. It was unimaginable, the sort of public insulting of people at meetings that you hear about in some of the sects. It just never ever happened. And also there was, with the Witnesses in those days, very little financial push. Somehow they managed to finance most of their organization. And actually the average person gave very little money into the organization. Now I think that's changed as their literature sales have gone down. Their financial position has got worse. So that's not quite the same. So the second thing about them is they are quite a rational sect, which sounds odd because you think, well, some of their beliefs are daft. But that being an English term, I presume it's transatlantic as well, silly. But you see, with the Jehovah's Witnesses, there was no emotionalism at all, no emotionalism. Every meeting, in fact, was fairly deadpan. You would have at the most an opening prayer and a song. There was no use of music to generate an atmosphere. There was just literally no emotionalism at all. And we just thought Pentecostalists were mad for all the emotionalism. So that meant some abuses were not there. And in those days, and it might be getting worse, might be, we weren't burdened with the sort of purity culture that you get in modern churches. I mean, the subject that it's interesting and amuses me that people hate talking about is masturbation. And even if I mention it at a house group, everybody goes, ooh, you know, you can talk about anything like homosexuality, like goodness knows what. But you hear stories of people who were like driven to distraction and thinking they were on the road to hell because they'd just done the deed. I mean, I had absolutely none of that when I was a Jehovah's Witness. And I had the normal growing up pains of a young man, boy becoming a man, with none of that sort of pressure. And even in relationships between boys and girls, there was none of this nonsense that you can't hold hands until you're engaged. I mean, there was quite a lot of fairly serious, you know, stuff going on. And although, again, you weren't allowed to cross the line, people got pretty close to the line. So this sort of mad purity culture, which you hear about even in some totally Orthodox Christian churches, that wasn't there. Now, I have some evidence that that's getting worse. And the last one is in those days, and here it definitely has got worse. I remember the change coming in. In those days, if you just left without doing anything to slag the witnesses off or to publicly oppose them, if you just decided you didn't want it anymore, they left you alone and you retained all your friends, you weren't shunned. And that was true when I started. And I remember when it came in, because I was then talking to somebody who had left the witnesses, and I remember her saying that she'll have to go back because otherwise she'll lose her friends. And so now their rule is, if you ever become a baptized Jehovah's Witness and stop attending, even if you've done nothing else wrong, they will totally shun you. And that's true of quite a lot of sects, but in the early days it was not true.
It's really interesting that you describe it like that. I have, as you know, if you've listened to the podcast, I've worked with some cult experts, and the Jehovah's Witnesses are considered by them to be very destructive, and they compare Branhamism much the same. But as I was working with them, and actually there was more than one that was talking about the Jehovah's Witnesses, I was thinking as they were talking, man, what I came out of in Branhamism was so far worse than what you're describing. And I'm not certain that the same criteria is even close to matching, but it's interesting that you say that. And I do wonder if the version that you saw in the UK was just slightly different than what we had in the United States. Maybe it just had not developed in the same way, which, you know, I don't know. I've not studied the Jehovah's Witness as they exist today as much as other people have. But like I said, it's interesting that you brought that up. The thing that most people need to realize, though, is whenever you have a group that is controlling your behavior, they are limiting or controlling the amount of information, they're manipulating your thoughts or trying to make you think a certain way, and manipulating your emotions and trying to build the religious belief set off of the heels of your emotion, it's matching all the criteria for a destructive cult. And there are levels of these. I would say Branhamism is far off the charts, but that's my opinion, and we can run with my opinion, I guess.
Yeah, and there seems to be a lot more personal nasty interactions in congregations, where you get people falling out in front of congregations and calling people out and insulting people and almost literally sometimes driving them out. Because I suppose the difference is in the witnesses, the local leaders had virtually no autonomy because it was all centrally run. They did what they had to do, but their agenda was set. Whereas it looks like in Branhamism, the local leaders had a lot more freedom to pursue their own agenda, and they could do that often very destructively.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've been in groups where the minister was just publicly calling out somebody from behind the pulpit, and I've seen it where it was indirectly, everybody knew you know, who they were talking about. But I've also had people who are in the support groups that say they were actually called out by name in some of the churches. So it's very destructive if you think about it. And that's not how a Christian church should operate.
I mean, I've never even heard of anybody who's been subject to the sort of abuse I've heard about in Branhamism.
Yeah, I've heard about it some, maybe to not the same extreme, but some of the people who have left other cults and have reached out to me, they had something that was similar. But again, in Branhamism, it just seems to be so far worse, the way that they attack the people, and they attack their own people, which is really odd.
And also, again, to be fair to Jehovah's Witnesses, unless again they've got worse, although here I doubt it. When I was in the Witnesses, you were allowed to have quite a lot of doubts. All you were not allowed to do is publicly air them in front of the whole congregation. And I was in the Witnesses for years, and with certain people, I would openly share my doubts, and they were quite reasonable about them. They didn't freak out. Well, I mean, by the time they disfellowshipped me, I was actually standing outside assemblies distributing leaflets telling people that Jehovah's Witnesses was the wrong religion. So I suppose, in a sense, they had a bit of a semi-right to get rid of me. But up to that point, I'm still able to keep all my friends. And I'd just like to add one other thing, because there's one thing that JW's had, which was an act of genius, and I remember reading it in one of Charles's books. It was something like the fan in the hand doctrine, and it's to the effect that the JW's have persuaded their followers that getting things wrong and having to change their mind is a virtue.
Yeah, it's a crazy doctrine.
And so they now, I think on certain things, they're having great difficulty changing one of their really basic doctrines about 1914, but they definitely changed loads when I was there, and they prepared people. They sort of made a virtue of saying, we know we get things wrong and we have to change our mind. And that is quite skillful, and they do it in quite a subtle way. And it was interesting but I think only a very, very tiny part of Branhamism has had that. The only way in which they're getting easy now, because they are obviously losing members, is when I was at JW, you were pushed a lot to go from house to house selling magazines, and most people didn't like that. And in fact, you have to even put in weekly reports of how much you've done. And if you'd not done very much, you were viewed slightly as being not a good JW. But again, you weren't really persecuted. You were just viewed as weak, and people didn't get on to you about it. Now, maybe I had a reasonable JW congregation, and I think it may be that the purity culture may have got worse. And the one thing really where they have become more cult-like is in shunning everybody who even leaves the movement, which now they do, unfortunately. But I know which one I prefer between the JWs and Branhamism.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, it is a very destructive group that I came out of, and my family, we have scars that I'll probably have the rest of my life, as do many others who leave the Branham cult. So it is very difficult, but it's not to make light of people who leave the Jehovah's Witnesses, because I know I've read some of the story. In fact, I've watched documentaries of people who have left the JWs and many of the similar things that they experience. So I think maybe there's levels of destructiveness in various groups. I don't know how to explain it, other than maybe the flavor that they had in the UK was a little bit different than what we have in the States. It could be. So I'm curious, you have quite an extensive journey, which we'll get into some of the charismatic stuff in a minute, but what was it that actually led you out of the Jehovah's Witnesses?
Parts of their beliefs I can understand, but some of them are just so stupid that it's exceptionally difficult to see how a person with brains can continue to believe it. You see, so I can understand their problems with the Trinity, and I have been accused many times of being a bit unsound about the Trinity myself, which is why when people talk about oneness Pentecostal sects, I wish they would distinguish between the modalist Pentecostal sects and the Arian Pentecostalist sects, because modalism, I mean, I've no brief for Hobart Freeman at all. I mean, I'm sure he's a terrible person, but he gets me down when people lambast Jehovah's Witnesses for the people who died of blood transfusion and never mention the 400 people who died because they didn't seek doctor's assistance because they were being taught by some idiot who said they shouldn't see a doctor. But his definition, when he said, I believe in one God eternally revealed as Father, Son and Holy Spirit, and that's all I've got to say. I could live with that. I could live with that as a Christian, but not with the rest. But when you take, for instance, I'll just go just through a conversation you might have with Jehovah's Witnesses to show how they've just got to not face facts. So they have this extraordinary belief, which they could change at any time, because I don't know why they believe it, but they have this extraordinary belief that Christ's body was never raised. Okay, so yeah, I know. He was raised as a spirit, but his body was never raised. So you sort of say, okay. So it says in John chapter 2, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. Yeah. What's the temple? He was talking about the temple of what? His body. After his resurrection, his disciples remembered the words and believed. So he say, destroy this temple. What is the temple? It's his body. And in 3 days, I will raise it. What? His body up again. Oh, no, it doesn't mean that, I've got to say. It must. And that is when you get into those where you can sort of, it's like 2 and 2 equals 5 sort of beliefs that they have. And plus, in the end, the sheer silliness of a lot of their biblical interpretation. I mean, literally, they've had 5 attempts to exegete Revelation. Everyone contradicts the previous one. They've had about 5 attempts to sort out Daniel. Everyone, and after a while, you just think, these people just don't know what they're doing. They're just fools. And I think that's really what led me out of the Jehovah's Witness. I just couldn't really take it seriously as a from an intellectual point of view. So, I mean, that's it wasn't that people were horrible to me. In fact, they were quite, I got treated fairly well. My brother, who later became a Baptist minister from being a Jehovah's Witness, had a slightly harder time, but none of my friends in the JWs gave me a hard time, and they tried to convince me, but it's just nonsense. So it's very difficult to convert a Jehovah's Witness. What's very easy, and I've done it about 3 times, if somebody calls me in to a situation where a Jehovah's Witness is trying to convince somebody else, well, then it's quite easy to show that these JW, and that they're liars, and that they're complete phonies, because they've just not got the leg to stand on. And so, goodness knows. Actually, it's probably true that I don't know of any Jehovah's Witness of graduate education who stayed in the movement.
So you have the unique perspective of somebody who has been in a group that some cult experts have branded as a destructive group, and it made its way into the UK. And then at the same time, you had all of these other charismatic, Pentecostal, some Lateran movements coming into the UK, some of which were also destructive, such as the shepherding movement. I've been, as you know, I've been researching the shepherding movement as it came into the UK, people like Ern Baxter, Derek Prince, etc. And as I'm going through all of these people and all of these names, I'm starting to see that the potential for something very destructive to happen was there, obviously. But the way that the UK has adopted some of these religious practices is a little bit different than in the United States. So I wanted to ask you, from your perspective, did like the shepherding movement and some of these other very destructive things that were happening in the United States, did they make their way into the UK?
Yes, but the worst ones, no. So if you know, first of all, let me wind my story forward. When I joined the church, I became a standard Calvinist, joined a Reformed Congregationalist church, no interest in charismatic gifts whatsoever. If asked, I would say they'd cease, but we didn't even talk about it. It wasn't on our agenda. I increasingly got dissatisfied with this, because it is not the easiest thing in the world. When you're young, especially if you're a male, and especially if you're a slightly introverted male, you sort of don't worry about things like God predestinating people to eternal torment. You think, oh, well, if he did, so what? But as you become gradually morph into a sort of human being, you suddenly start finding these things absolutely outrageous, and you think, can you seriously believe this? And then the answer is no. I've been racking my brains to work out why we got involved with restoration. And I think it was because, well, first of all, the area of restoration I got involved with was the Calvinist wing, which isn't the main wing in the United States. There is a group led by Charles Mahaney, who's at the Sovereign Grace Ministries, with people like Larry Tomczak, both of whom I've had experience of at Bible weekends. But that's a minority, and I think that's even more in Canada than the United States. We joined a much more serious branch, and an interesting book on this is by Andrew Walker, which I recommended. But as he points out, the main drivers of restoration came out of the Plymouth Brethren rather than out of Pentecostalism, with two notable exceptions. One being a man called Terry Virgo, who you may or may not have heard of. He's probably the most successful leader of the group, and he's led the most successful grouping. And the other one, who was along with Arthur Wallace, who was Brethren, the real starter of Restoration, was Bryn Jones, who was Pentecostal from Wales. Interestingly, although he campaigned very much for the fivefold ministry, so far as is known, he never even considered the Apostolic Pentecostal movement, despite the fact that has its headquarters in Wales, which is sort of interesting, and apparently has quite a reach overseas, but has never really taken off in the UK. So Bryn and Arthur Wallace started the movement. Now, in the early days, there was a big place for Ern Baxter. And in some of the early meetings, including one of their first Bible weeks, he was the main speaker. And apparently he was received ecstatically. I mean, you know, people became real, real great fans of Ern Baxter. So that's one connection. There wasn't much of a connection with the other Fort Lauderdale people, but Ern Baxter became quite close. And there was a stage, I'm just reporting what I've read in the book rather than what I know from experience. There was an attempt made by the Fort Lauderdale Five to get the British leaders to submit to them, and it failed. Okay. So then you have Arthur Wallace coming along, and he... and I can believe this, according to Arthur Wallace, was as much influenced by Watchman Nee as he was. Now, is Watchman Nee a well-known name in the States?
I've come across him a few times in my research. I think I first came across him in The Voice of Healing, if I remember correctly. He's had some influence in the United States, but I don't know to what extent. It seems that he's a name that comes up with a few of my guests, so he's definitely had some influence, but I wouldn't say that he's as impactful as people like Mike Bickle and the Kansas City Fellowship.
Yeah, now, like in England, at that stage, I was still in the Reformed churches. And when I was in my mid-20s, he was probably the most widely read author. I mean, everybody was keen on Watchman Nee and the Normal Christian Life. But he also had discipleship views, which arguably were even more extreme than Derek Prince's. He wrote a book on the subject, which even included going so far as to say you must obey your leader if he's doing something wrong. The important thing is to obey your leader. And of course, Watchman Nee had quite a strong connection at one stage with the Brethren, even the Exclusive Brethren, until they fell out. So it is almost certainly, I think it's provably the case, that Arthur Wallace got his views on shepherding as much from Watchman Nee as he did from Ern Baxter, and from his own character. And a lot of the anti-denominationalism in the English movement is because it came out of Brethrenism, and Brethrenism, which was quite an important movement in the 19th century, always rejected the denominations and always was quite anti the established church, because their founder, J.N. Darby, was an Anglican minister at one stage. And so these people like Arthur Wallace and Brin never really connected at all with the Anglican stream of renewal which was going on. They really thought the Anglicans should leave the Anglican church and join their church.
You know, one of the things that I really have been interested to find out, and your perspective from the UK is a good fit for this, as it relates to some of the other countries like the UK, I'm curious how much the latter rain is discussed and mentioned today. As you know, probably from watching my podcast, the latter rain movement was really, really popular in the late 1940s, somewhat in the early 1950s, but then it evolved into different things. And one of those was the post-World War II healing revival, which William Branham spearheaded by all accounts. And what happened was, after this, when he died, the charismatic movement went forward on many of the ideas and concepts that emerged because of latter rain. But what happened was, they started to say Branham went astray, and they started kind of, I hate, for lack of a better way to say it, they erased part of that history. So it wasn't until recently, like the God's Generals publication, these kind of things traced that history, and they started to speak very favorably about that which was cut off, which is kind of funny if you think about it. I'm wondering if they did the same thing in the UK. Was the latter rain something that you had heard about, or was this something new?
You know, I'd never even heard about the latter rain until I started listening to your podcast. I mean, I knew the term was used in a more general sense. And a lot of the people who are very well known at your side of the Atlantic aren't on ours. I'd never heard of William Branham. Never once. And I checked with Charles's book, because he gives a list of possible Branhamist churches in England, and there's about six, and I checked three of them, and they still exist, but say that's still six in the whole of the United Kingdom or something like that. So I don't think we were very much influenced by it or knew much about it, but what really led us to stand apart from Restoration, well, first of all, we knew they were very heavy on shepherding, but we never got close to see how bad that went. What really put us off is they had their own obsession with eschatology. And it seems to me that's what separates what I would call the restorationists and the NAR from more, say, traditional renewal movements like HTB. Holy Trinity doesn't have the same obsession with eschatology. And although I never heard any of the more lurid ideas about the manifest sons of God, it is without doubt that they were obsessed with the coming revival. And literally just could not talk about anything else. And I mean, in the end, we got so fed up, especially since I'd heard it all in the JWs, the revival's round the corner, the revival's round the corner. And I remember we got to the stage where you thought, we've been going to church for 6 months, we've not heard a single message about the Gospels or anything like that. Every message was, the revival's around the corner. And it was more a classical post-millennial doctrine than some of the more lurid ideas of people, you know, rebuking the waves and causing thunderstorms and weird ideas. But it was definitely their view that there was going to be a huge end-time revival, so that when Jesus returns, the world will have turned to Christ. And they almost literally couldn't think of anything else. And in the end, it just totally put us off. It alienated us from the movement.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. You mentioned that the revival culture that you experienced, in it, the gospel seemed to take second place, and over time it just was non-existent. I can confirm this from what I grew up in. For 37 years, I had never, ever heard the gospel of Jesus Christ, not once. In fact, whenever we went to other churches, I began to first understand what the gospel even was. Now, I thought I knew. We would talk about the gospel, and it was the power or the healing or so many different things, but the actual gospel as it is stated in the Bible, I didn't know it. And it's not that I think that there were a lot of people who were Christian in the movement who probably did know the gospel, but I was raised in such a way that it took second place, and it wasn't that important to me. And now that I'm out of this, I'm starting to realize that if you're a Christian, that should be the most important thing. It should never be the second place thing. And I've come to form an opinion that the revival culture itself is destructive, because you get into this hype that something's coming that never comes. You start to, as a Christian group, you start to make the gospel take second place in the group. And what you build up is something that, for lack of a better way to say it, it's this fantasy that never plays out. And I know that there are people that believe some of the predictions that are made in this revival culture. But for me, it really, if you're putting the gospel on the shelf so that you can take focus on this revival culture, it's just something that's not, in my opinion, it's not a Christian thing. Which leads you to the other question. As not a Christian thing, what happens is you get a lot of leaders in the movement who they themselves may or may not be Christian. And there's always some question. There's always people who are doing things that are very unchristian-like, and some of them very bad things that they're doing. How much of that existed in the UK?
There were signs of less desirable things. We had two friends who, when we decided to stand apart from the movement, they went in. And they went into a church at Southampton, which we knew very well. And that church was into kingdom businesses. Now, I don't know how big a thing that is with the charismatic movement in America. It may have come from their brethren background, because you probably know.
I know to some extent, but for the listeners, describe this to the people. I know to some extent, but for those who don't know, describe this for the listeners.
Well, they were just simple. It was similar to the brethren idea, like the exclusive brethren, because you should not be unevenly yoked. You shouldn't be unevenly yoked at work. So it wasn't so much what type of business, it's just they wanted to create loads of businesses which were staffed and owned by people in the restoration movement. You know, and like today, one of the reasons why the exclusive brethren are so wealthy is they've built up all these businesses, and lots of people are locked into the brethren because they're all buying their houses on interest-free loans. They work for brethren-originated businesses, and if they left the movement, they'd lose everything. And our friends were at Southampton until they felt they were being ripped off by one of these kingdom businesses, and they came back quite disillusioned, and they thought there was a lot of dishonesty creeping in. And I think the Southampton church has faded. But the main church, just if I take my hat from my house, within 5 miles, there are now at least 9 churches which are part of Terry Virgo's network. And a number of churches are still joining. And this is one of the accusations about church stealing. Now, I don't know the details, but I know 2 churches near us, which were just standard, we call them independent conservative Baptist churches, where after a meeting of the church, they decided to skip and join Terry Virgo's network of churches. And one poor bloke left one church because he didn't want to join it. He went to the next nearby independent Baptist church, and that one also joined it. So there's about nine different, within 5 miles of my house, there's about nine different fellowships. So it's spreading. But I think it must be calming down now. And so then we went to a charismatic Baptist church, and that was much more in the mainstream of British charismatic churches. It wasn't eschatologically obsessed. It was just a more bog standard Baptist church with gifts of the Spirit. Fell apart when the minister revealed he'd been having an affair with one of the other members for about 5 years. But I mean, that's not original.
No, it's not.
Well, certainly in England now, I mean, what really alienates people from NAR is Donald Trump. You know, because there's an interesting podcast, and it's called Charismatic Revival Fury. That's it, by some people who were in the movement. And they are. It's really all about the build-up to the 6th of January storming of the Capitol and the involvement of the NAR in all that. And for reasons which you can perhaps understand, since Donald Trump is always slagging the UK off, he makes sure that anything associated with him is viewed with a very, very sort of distrustful gaze now by anybody in the UK. So I think if you asked Terry Virgo whether he was associated with NAR, he'd probably be quite conflicted. He'd appreciate a lot of their theology, but at the same time, he'd be thinking he wouldn't touch Donald Trump with two barge poles tied together. And that's almost a distinguishing feature now of NAR, that they are 110% Trumpists.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. It's kind of odd because if I mention Trump, I get all kinds of backlash. You can see it in the comment feeds. But you almost can't talk about the New Apostolic Reformation without talking about Trump, because they have merged politics and Christianity together to create this rare breed of Christian. And, you know, I hate to say it, but, I guess I'll say it like this. If you take anything and mix it with Christianity, once it's mixed, what you end up with is not Christianity, it's something else. And as one of my other co-hosts used to say, that's something else. One of the things that you mentioned, you talked about Virgo and you talked about Ern Baxter and part of the shepherding movement. I'm curious how much contact or interaction you had with doctrines or even with the person of Derek Prince.
I very little. When I was, even before I came at all involved with this, I was then living somewhere different, and rumours of the shepherding movement were beginning to surface, mainly from friends of ours who were in a denominational Assemblies of God church, and most people just thought Derek Prince was the Prince of Darkness. I mean, he was viewed as really, really sinister, but we didn't know much about him. But it's true that Restoration, and particularly Bryn Jones, but even all of the Restoration movement, was pretty close to the principles of shepherding which Derek Prince developed. It was known for it, and you had to commit to allowing all the leaders to speak into your life, and things like mandatory tithing were quite common, and a number of people had bad experiences, and there was some, but not the same amount, of manipulative prophecy. The prophet's role never seemed to quite get the same traction in the UK as it did from the States, but you did get some of that. And I'm fairly sure that if we got further involved into Restoration, it would have started to chafe. Even though I think I can see the argument, but I just don't think it works. And interesting, I don't know whether this is something you've heard. One thing Andrew Walker says, which I just found impossible to believe, he said one of the primary influences of Ern Baxter was Juan Carlos Ortiz from Argentina. Have you ever heard that? That sounds really weird.
It sounds really familiar, but You know, so I did a lot of research whenever I was doing my Colonia Dignidad research, because William Branham, one of William Branham's security detail in Germany, started a colony that became infamous in South America called Colonia Dignidad in Chile. But as I was doing that research, there were so many other tentacles of this that I really haven't explored them all. But Argentina had a thick latter rain post-World War II healing revival presence, which is really odd. In fact, somewhere, if I can find it, I doubt I can find it for this podcast, but I have a photograph of William Branham with I think it's a person in Argentina. And I know that there were others that went into Argentina, but it's just one of the South American countries that they went into. They were trying to go into South America, and I tied that to some of my Nixon research, and it got a little bit weird, because it seems that there was more going on than just religion, but that's another podcast for another day.
Yeah, well, there is one stream which we haven't dealt with now. It's worth knowing because it's another quite major stream of influence, and that's an organization called New Wine. And New Wine is mainly, but not exclusively, Anglican. So in some ways, it's in competition with HTB, although they're somewhat different. And that was formed by a guy called David Pitches, who went to the States and became absolutely gobsmacked taken in by the Kansas City Prophets, and he couldn't get enough of them. And he came back and he wrote a book about Some Say It Thundered, praising the KFC IHOP to the clouds, and he brought John Wimber in, and more unfortunately, he was the one who introduced Paul Kane into the United Kingdom. So Pitches set up this organization called New Wine, which did have a lot of influence, had a lot of input from John Wimber and quite a lot of input from Paul Kane, but all the Anglican churches like Holy Trinity Brompton had people like Paul Kane, and he had quite a reputation, having been given that reputation by John Wimber. And really, New Wine was originally formed to try and bring the message of John Wimber and the Kansas City Prophets into the UK, because HTB wasn't doing it. And it now is quite a large organisation. It seems to want to act as a training organisation to get churches to adopt a more charismatic style. It has about 1,000 churches that it influences throughout the world, but there is evidence that it managed to avoid some of the worst excesses. So, like John Wimber, it took a very standoffish attitude towards the Toronto Blessing. And when Bill Johnson came in and tried to get them to adopt the Pentecostal idea that, oh, God wants everybody to be healed in every case whatsoever, again, they considered that and quietly rejected it. So they're probably now moving to a more moderate position. Now, I don't know that they've ever officially voiced a rejection of the Kansas City Prophets. I think they've just more distanced themselves from them and probably just don't talk about it very much. You know, if you go on their website, when they started off, front and center on the website was signs and wonders. Now you've got to search their website to find signs and wonders. So I think they're trying to morph, because they've also, of course, you've got to realize a lot of these people are commercial organizations. I mean, New Wine has 80 employees, turnover of 4.5 million quid, which I know is small change in American circles, but in English circles, 4.5 million quid. Pounds, I should say, is quite a lot. And so there's a limited customer base. You've got Evangelical Alliance, which hosts nationwide jamborees and has got to keep its organisation on the road. And you've got New Wine, got to keep its organisation on the road. And we just don't have the level of religiosity that you have in the United States. So I think these people are always going to be struggling to keep up their customer base, really. The church I go to has mild connections with New Wine, but I wouldn't say it's all in. It's sort of sympathetic.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me, but just simply for the name, New Wine, the Shepherding's primary publication was New Wine, and that's where I was able to start to connect John Wimber to Shepherding through the New Wine magazine, and Christian Identity to Shepherding through the New Wine magazine. So many different ways to explore, but it's a different organization. It just has the same name.
Yeah. And I think in its early days, it was a lot more militant. But quite a lot of the, I think even HTB at one stage was, I mean, they have a lot of, had a lot of American preachers, you know, like Bill Johnson, Joyce Meyer. Paul Kane was very honoured by HTB. But I believe in the end, now most people, you see, this is one of the more interesting things about your podcast, is that dealing honestly with the person of John Wimber is one of the more difficult things, because first of all, people are very reluctant to criticize him because he's like Mr. Nice Guy, and he did roll back from a lot of his extreme views, but only very shortly before his death. But I mean, from what I know, one of the major developments in the American scene was when John Wimber disassociated with the Toronto Blessing, and that led a split between the people who looked to him and those who looked to the more radical NAR people who embraced Toronto. And so John Wimber then almost formed a separate offshoot. And I think it is actually quite difficult to be fair to him, because people like Derek Prince are very easy to dislike. Do you know what I mean? I mean, John Wimber seems to, I've never met him, of course, but John Wimber seems to be the person, the acceptable face of radical charismatic Christianity is John Wimber.
Yeah, it's really difficult, because if you say anything about John Wimber, you have all of these people who are just so beholden to him that they'll fight you tooth and nail. And yet, at the same time, he's an important, very important intersection piece between all of this, especially in the UK, as you know. So you have to be very careful how you say it, but it is really important. And the more important thing to understand, I think, is it's irrelevant to try to consider the person. It's more about the movement. And the movement brought such destruction. So when you look at this intersection point, which Wimber was a part of, and then understand what happened next, I think it's key to understand why, because you don't want to repeat the same mistakes.
The harm done by the movement in America at the moment, or the potential harm, is political, and only it's a wise man who will try and predict what will happen to that whole movement if and when Trump's star wanes, and I just don't know.
So you've listened to my podcast, and you are aware of both what happened in the UK and then the research that we've been creating and publishing. And I'm curious, I want your feedback, and I want the good, bad, and the ugly. How did we do? When you look at some of these leaders and what they caused, from your perspective, would you say that what we have researched is accurate, or would you say we're way off mark? What is your perspective?
I think one of the problems there are with a lot of these leaders is rumors which can't be substantiated, and what you do with them. So I know that the rumour is that Irm Baxter was a womaniser. If the only witness to that is William Branham, then I wouldn't describe him as a reliable witness. But once the rumour's out there, it's very difficult to know what to do with it. When you come to things like Parham's supposed homosexuality, there are things that you can say, but I think those things are often very difficult to deal with. So it means that I don't quite know what to do about Irm Baxter, whether he was a genuine type or, I mean, whether he was a naughty person. I just don't know about that. That's left in limbo.
Yeah, as a researcher, that's one of the really hard things. Irm Baxter, we have one person who's saying it, And if it's just one, can you believe it? I don't know. But here's the thing, and this is why I included in the research, because it is a supporting point to another bigger problem. Within William Branham's inner circle, you had all kinds of different issues, some of which the people were just very immoral. I'll say it like that and keep it G-rated for the podcast. So in this inner circle, you have so many different things that you can confirm, but named in that same inner circle is Ern Baxter by one person who was in the inner circle, who had knowledge. I tend to believe him, but from a researcher standpoint, you can't say this is absolute proof. You can only say this person said that, and he mentions his quote about Ern Baxter. So I get what you're saying, but it is a supporting point of a much larger scope of research.
Yeah, and that is one of the sad things about Branhamism, because in a sense, there's nobody worse. Well, there are, but the worst thing to be is a sort of unreconciled homosexual who can't control themselves, because it means that every encounter you have with somebody else, you can't have loving feelings towards the person who you were partnering with, because you believe they've led you into sin. In fact, you could quite often be fairly abusive towards them. It's like expecting a man to show love to a prostitute after having had sex with her, and it's just such a sad way to live your life.
Yeah. It really is. From your perspective, charismatic movement coming into the UK, there are people who talk about some good things that came in, and I won't argue the case there. There probably are, but there were also some bad things. From your perspective, how do you see it? Was this a good thing that came into the UK? Was it bad? What is your opinion?
Well, I think the influence was bad, because I can't think of any distinctive teaching that they brought in. I mean, the renewal movement was getting on quite well without them. And so when you say, well, what are the distinctive things that they brought in? Well, mainly it was their views on demon possession and strategic spiritual warfare. And both of them, particularly demon possession, I mean, that is probably one of the most destructive doctrines that you can get. Now, to be fair, I've never witnessed it, but I do know from people who were in the congregation, Dave Pitch's congregation, where all this did spring from, that they did occasionally take people off and have them de-demonized. And so, and of course, Paul Kane tried to get them to believe in the end time revival. And I don't know how much damage he did, because to be honest, most people in England still haven't really heard very much about Paul Kane. And he hasn't had maybe all that much influence, but what influence he's had, I wouldn't say has been good. I mean, the fact that he was a decent musician, we had decent musicians before. You know, I mean, you don't need another decent musician. And I find him quite a difficult character to sort of wrap my brain around. It would have been better if he'd stayed away.
Well, thank you so much. This has been crazy interesting, and I'm certain that the listeners are probably as fascinated as I am by hearing it. So thank you so much for doing this.
That's all right. I've enjoyed it. It's really good fun.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.